This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the Securities and Exchange Commission makes up its mind on advertising. We'll take you out to the North Dakota oil fields, and we'll talk to the guy who decides what we see on Netflix. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 10th of July. Good, as always, to have you tuning in. There is, I would venture, an advertisement for pretty near everything you can think of in this economy. Liquor and lawyers, pet manicurists and podiatrists. One thing missing, though, from the great American advertising landscape has been a chance to get in on private investments, startups and hedge funds and venture capital. The Securities and Exchange Commission took care of that 80-year-long oversight today. It voted to lift a ban on publicly soliciting your investment dollars outside of the stock market. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the risks and the rewards.
If I run a startup and I want to put an ad in the paper that says, "Hey, rich people, give me some money," I can't do that. That's illegal. But that's about to change. And for some people, that's a good thing.
The laws that are being lifted right now have really propagated an old boys network.
Ryan Kaldbeck runs Circle Up, a firm that connects investors with private opportunities. He says right now, only big shot investors even know about the best deals. Now, the new rules still limit these investments to so-called accredited investors, people who are worth $1 million. But Kaldbeck says only a fraction of those people actually invest in private companies or hedge funds.
We don't think it's that the other 90% wouldn't have an interest in it. But the cost for them to find these companies is just too high.
The new advertising would let needy startups publicize themselves and get more financing and maybe create jobs. It could also create scams, according to Heath Absher, Arkansas's security commissioner.
There's a huge dark gray storm cloud coming.
Absher predicts we'll get a proliferation of investment ads on websites and spam emails, on billboards even. Some of them will be fraudulent, some of them will be just plain risky, and people could lose money.
Eventually, investors will no longer trust this market, and when investors don't trust the market, no investment in small companies are made, and no job growth occurs.
For now, the ads will focus on the rich. The SEC is still debating rules for how private companies can market themselves to the rest of us. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Republicans in the House of Representatives have been meeting this afternoon to talk immigration reform. They've called the plan the Senate passed a couple of weeks ago dead on arrival. Still, though, with an eye on last November's elections, some pro-immigration conservative groups are trying to change GOP minds the old-fashioned way by advertising to them. Kate Davidson reports.
Switch on Fox News during primetime this week, and you might see this.
It's called the Border Surge, the toughest border security plan ever passed by Congress.
Dan Constant is communications director for the American Action Network. That's the center-right advocacy group responsible for the spot.
This latest ad push is a $100,000 plus ad buy targeted at conservatives, lauding the specific components of the Border Surge plan.
Carl Rove's Crossroads GPS also spent $100,000 on pro-reform ads. In fact, immigration supporters dished out about $2.5 million advertising dollars during the first half of the year. Now, that might sound like a lot, but it's actually not. Remember New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's $12 million ad campaign for gun control? That didn't work so well. So should pro-immigration groups spend more? Republican strategist Alex Vogel says there's just no momentum.
We are at a point where people don't see this trending in the right direction, so they're not going to throw perceived good money after bad, number one. Number two, unlike the gun debate, there is no NRA on immigration.
Meaning there are no monolithic groups to dominate the airwaves or fight against. Vogel says it's normal not to see huge ad buys on an issue like immigration. He says this is a grassroots issue in which targeting voters through calls and emails is more effective than reaching Congress through TV. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
A peek at the minutes of the last Fed meeting didn't really do it for traders today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know when I say the National Security Agency has been keeping a closer eye on us than many might like. What you might not know is how much the NSA and law enforcement are paying for the privilege. Thanks to the Associated Press today, we now have a pretty specific idea about how much Verizon and AT&T and Google charge every time Uncle Sam wants to know what we're up to. Not that metadata we've heard so much about, but actual wiretaps and surveillance. Ann Flaherty covers technology for the Associated Press. She wrote the story today. Ann, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So I'll tell you what, we read your article this morning and we were basically like, wait, what? The government is paying for this to the phone companies? Huh?
Right. Basically, what we found out was that virtually every company out there, technology company or telecommunications company, charges the government, with the exception of Facebook, which gives the information away for free.
Nice of them. When you say charge the government, that is to say taxpayers.
That's right. They give them a bill that says you have asked for certain information on our users, and this is the amount that it will cost for us to supply it to you.
And they're allowed to do that.
They are allowed to do that. Basically, there's a section in the law that says companies can be reimbursed if law enforcement or an intelligence agency like the NSA comes knocking at your door and says, look, this is a matter of national security, or we're trying to track a drug dealer and we need your help. So if it puts the business out, they have the right to be compensated. So they've been doing this since the early 1990s, and they've developed these really sophisticated fee lists that say basically, if you want access to our data, okay, it's going to cost, you know, $750 to set up the wiretap. It's $500 a month after that. If you want our experts to testify in court, it's, you know, $50 an hour and so forth.
And it very quickly gets into the millions of American dollars.
It does. This is a, you know, a technical feat to try to intercept communications
right
as they're happening. So they do spend quite a bit of money on that. I talked to quite a few people who said, you know what, look, I don't actually think it's that much money. I think that what they're trying to do is cover just some of their costs, defray some of their costs. AT&T says they have 100 people working full-time, 24/7, just to deal with law enforcement.
Can you say that surveillance is a profit center for these telecommunications and internet companies?
I don't think we can go that far right now. The question is, are they making any money off of this? We don't know. How much money is being spent? I went to the FBI and tried to track this down, and they said, you know, we can't give you a top line figure. We don't know how much we spend on reimbursements because it's divided up across the budget with every field office and every program. So we don't really know.
Don't we want some friction here? Don't we want the government to have to think about the price or the cost of getting our data?
Right, exactly. This is what makes this issue so difficult is, do you give it away for free and have law enforcement or intelligence agencies knocking on Google's door, AT&T's door every 2 minutes asking for information? Or do you charge for it and even overcharge for it to discourage that sort of surveillance? But at the same time, that's taxpayer dollars. And I don't think there's a good answer to it, but I do think that there could be more transparency to the process. We don't know how much the United States government is spending on these reimbursements. We don't know how much companies are making off of these reimbursements. We just don't know a lot about it.
My favorite line in this whole piece was the part where somebody from the government said, yeah, you know, if there's confusion in the billing, if we don't understand the billing, well, we try to call them and see if we can figure things out. And I was like, you too, the government, me, the consumer, we're the same, man. We don't understand our cell phone bill.
That's just it. As I can't imagine, you know, the law enforcement guy who's buried in paperwork already and trying to complete a drug bust and having to go back to AT&T or Verizon and say, you know, what was this bill from 6 months ago?
Right.
Yeah, I don't think that they do it.
Ann Flaherty, she covers technology for the Associated Press. Ann, thanks a bunch.
I appreciate it.
We've done a bunch of stories the past year or two about how the energy boom in this country is changing global energy markets, fracking, for one. Also, the oil fields of North Dakota. All that new production out there is giving even the Middle East more competition. But it all starts with an oil rig and the men who keep it going. Independent radio producer Todd Melby has been working on a series called Black Gold Boom, about the people in North Dakota and their stories. Today, the basic building block of an oil boom, the roughneck.
My name's Tate, go by Tater. The oil business will either make you or break you. It'll make a man out of you.
Were you a man before you started?
I thought I was. This is a whole nother deal up here.
What's the toughest thing you do?
Trip pipe, like what they're doing out there right now. Going in is a lot faster pace. You don't get to eat as much. A lot of the guys, I'm one of them, carry food around in your pockets and stuff like that. Got thousands of feet to go in the hole and got to get her done. And sometimes lunch pail is a little far away. When I first got here, Will, or Derek Han, he told me that we come to work together, we go home together. I watch your back, you watch my back. Everybody does. If they see something going on, something that's swinging around, you're standing there, yeah, we tell you, hey, heads up, coming over top. We're family. We travel together. We sleep in the same cabin. Work together. Yeah, we're pretty much family. The shower you use Dawn dish soap. That's the only thing I can cut through all the. Yeah, you can try all the Axe, Snake Peel, Zest, Body Wash, Old Spice you want. Dawn dish soap is the best.
What'd your mom and dad say about you working here?
Mom don't get told quite as much as dad does, but dad not quite as much. You know, he still worries about me, but he's more or less just proud of me. He told me I got the world by the tail up here if I just stick it out.
Todd Melby's series, Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Local Ore and the Association of Independents in Radio. Coming up, the Netflix strategy in one simple sentence.
It's middle of the night and you have to get up early, but you still stay up and watch one more.
That's me. But first, let's do the numbers. Release of those Fed minutes didn't quell speculation the central bank is going to cut stimulus efforts later this year, although Ben Bernanke tried once again to quiet things down in a speech he gave late this afternoon. All the same, the Dow Industrials closed at 15,291. That's a loss of 8 points for the blue chips, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ added 16 points, about a half percent, ended things at 3520. The S&P 500 basically unchanged, 1652, the number there. Financials took a hit. Bank of America counted a loss of 1.2%. Wells Fargo staged a loss of 1.5%. Earnings season was still on investors' minds as Nabors Industries drilled down nearly 6.3%. The oil rig giant warned yesterday its second quarter operating profits would fall below expectations. Better news for family dollar stores. The discount retailer stacked up a gain of more than 7% today as they beat estimates. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose just a touch, 2.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events happening tomorrow. What were consumers up to in June? Chain stores are slated to reveal how much cash ended up in the register last month. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing on assessing the transition in Afghanistan. And the United Nations marks World Population Day. We've grown from 1 billion in 1810 to more than 7 billion in 2012, and we continue to lose elbow room. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A federal judge in New York had some harsh words for everybody's favorite company today. She said Apple, quote, played a central role in facilitating and executing a conspiracy to raise prices on e-books. At the time of said collusion with five big publishers, Amazon was selling e-books for about $9.99. That price didn't sit well with said publishers. So Apple proposed $12.99 and $14.99, the catch being whatever price the publishers chose, they had to promise to sell the book to other retailers at that same price. But price aside, how does one decide what ebooks are worth? We sent Marketplace's Queen of Kim to find out.
How much should an ebook cost? Alan Weiner is an analyst at Gartner, and he says the answer is simple.
The cardinal rule for digital ebooks is you want to sell them for as much as you can.
Weiner says it's not that much different from selling hard copies. For new blockbusters, publishers generally start by releasing a hardback that can cost up to $30. Fans rush out to buy it, and when that demand ends, the publisher slashes the price. The price depends on how much readers are willing to pay. And that's where pricing ebooks gets tricky. Ted Hill is with THA Consulting, which focuses on new technologies in publishing.
Generally, publishers spend much more on developing and creating and finding new authors and marketing titles than they actually do on printing and shipping them.
He says, sure, ebooks aren't as expensive to produce, but acquiring books from big-name authors like John Grisham still requires a cash advance of millions or even tens of millions of dollars. And it doesn't matter whether it's published as an ebook or hardcover. Also complicating the ebook pricing equation is the continued popularity of real books. Jeremy Greenfield is the editorial director of Digital Book World, which publishes an ebook bestseller list.
Hardcovers are a very lucrative business.
Greenfield says ebooks occasionally sell for upwards of $20. That's because publishers are loath to cannibalize sales of hardcovers. But he says readers don't want to pay that much for ebooks, and publishers are getting the message. This week, the average ebook bestseller was about $7. Last year, that price was $13. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
The Food and Drug Administration does more than just food and drugs, you know. It's taking public comment right now on some guidelines it's proposing for medical devices, things like implanted pacemakers and insulin pumps, and specifically how to make them safer. The agency wants manufacturers to improve their cybersecurity, as Gigi Duban reports.
Maybe you remember this little scene from the show Homeland.
You okay? I don't know.
In it, a terrorist hacks into the vice president's pacemaker. His heart goes haywire, and the guy dies. Paul Castellanos is a surgeon at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He remembers watching the episode and thinking, no way.
I just didn't believe that that was possible. Subsequently, I have researched the issue, and I found I was wrong.
Thing is, a lot of pacemakers are controlled remotely, and as with a lot of wireless-enabled devices, they can be hacked pretty easily.
I suspect that most doctors assumed that it was not possible to render these devices dangerous. And I was truly shocked that that wasn't the case.
Shocked, Castellanos says, because the FDA has to certify all medical devices are safe and effective. The FDA told me this week it's aware of dozens of cybersecurity incidents affecting hundreds of devices, but that as far as the agency knows, no patients have been harmed. Still, the FDA recently put out new guidelines requiring manufacturers to keep their devices safe from cyber attacks. The medical device industry is worth more than $300 billion. Manufacturers might have to make lots of changes to their products to protect against hacking. Jim Horton is an engineer at Biotronic, which makes pacemakers and implanted defibrillators.
Getting it to work under normal conditions is about 20% of the job. 80% of the job is looking at it and thinking, what are all the ways that something could screw the system up, either consciously or maliciously?
But even companies like Biotronic say working with cutting-edge technology and protecting against the latest threats is a constant balancing act. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
You look at some of the new shows on Netflix, like House of Cards with Kevin Spacey and the much-awaited return of Arrested Development, and you can tell That company just isn't waiting on producers anymore. It's making its own shows. And then it's dropping them online so you can watch all of them, 13 episodes apiece, give or take, in one sitting, should you so choose. Their latest offering, Orange is the New Black, premieres tonight, and a second season has already been ordered up. Ted Sarandos is Chief Content Officer at Netflix. Ted, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here.
It occurs to me that, making, in essence, a show that people are going to binge watch, right? That's the new thing. It's not unlike making a 13-hour movie, really. So does that change how you program things? Did that change how you look for shows?
We want to create shows and create worlds that people can spend a lot of time with. And it's funny, you know, people talk a lot about binge viewing, like, you know, as if people actually clear the calendar, you know, put some toothpicks in their eyes and watch TV. But the truth of it is, most people watch a couple of episodes at a time. But this is really programmed to be addictive programming, the kind of storytelling that keeps you hooked when you know it's middle of the night and you have to get up early, but you still stay up and watch one more. And those are the kind of shows that we look for, and we think Orange is one of those.
And it changes, I mean, even how you write the show, because you don't have to deal with the whole previously on Orange is the New Black and coming up next week, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's actually probably the most profound part of the change, which is typically on a TV series, the writers of the show are writing for their life almost every episode.
Hmm.
When someone sits down to write a Netflix show, they know there's going to be a 13th hour when they write the first hour. And that really does impact your ability to tell stories.
Why did you guys go to original programming? I mean, that's all the rage these days. Amazon's doing it. Everybody and their dog is doing it. Why did you guys decide to do it?
So we have a big subscriber base, as you know,
and
they have a big appetite for serialized drama. So when we started looking at this and looking at the bigger television ecosystem, you start seeing that there's not that many great serialized TV shows being made for TV because the economics are lousy. They don't sell into syndication well. The DVD sales that used to be quite dependable are no longer that dependable. And they're very expensive to produce.
Yeah.
And that perhaps if this is what our subscribers want to watch, we should, you know, learn the muscle of creating it for them.
Who's your competition? Are you worried about Amazon Video and HBO Go and all of them?
Yeah, anyone who is trying to get the attention of a viewer is competition on some level. I don't know that our specific competitor has really emerged yet at all. Channels like HBO are becoming much more like Netflix, and we need to stay ahead of the curve in terms of original programming and technology enhancements to make things not just make the content that people watch better, but make the experience of watching it better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we are unique in the cable universe in that our business is purely direct to consumer. We're constantly asking our customers how we're doing because it's so simple and easy to join and so simple and easy to quit.
You guys also have the liberty, it seems to me, of not having to worry about what the ratings are, the external ratings, and in some way what the critics say, because you have all this data on us. You know how many of us are going to watch this thing. You know how many of us are watching House of Cards. I mean, you know all that stuff.
Yeah, and we know with a pretty high degree of confidence going in. Now, of course, these shows have got to execute well, but I always love that phrase when people say that this is a good idea, but it's execution dependent.
Yeah.
As if anything in life is not execution dependent. Hmm. As if breathing is execution dependent. So, yes, we have all the elements of a good show that lines up with the viewing data that we have, but it's still the show has to be well executed. We're obviously taking a very different model than the networks. You know, some of the networks are developing 50 to 70 pilots a year. And that's a lot of programming that never gets seen by anybody. So I think in some ways it's far less risky for me to produce a whole season of content. And then I'm just risking that we do a good job of audience matching, which is what we, you know, do best.
You must actually get sick and tired of watching television. I mean, come on, right?
No, I do this because I love it. I mean, I do this because I absolutely
love it. Come on. You have to watch television like 19 hours a day.
I grew up in front of a television.
Yeah, well,
to me, it's an extension of my childhood, what I'm doing here. So I love it.
Ted Sarandos, he's the Chief Content Officer at Netflix. Their new series, Orange is the New Black, hits the web tonight at midnight. Ted, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Once upon a time, getting the day's mail was a big deal. Letters, cards, more bills probably than you'd care for. Now it's not worth opening the mailbox most days, but charities haven't quite gotten that message, as commentator Susan Levine points out.
The National Park Foundation just sent me, unsolicited, 90 return address labels. Labels with my name and tiny pictures of iconic landmarks. You know, the Statue of Liberty, Mount Rushmore, Old Faithful. I paused for a moment to toss or not to toss, and then I punted. Into a file they all went, joining more than a dozen other sheets of labels. Exactly what year do charities and nonprofits think it is? 2013 or 1983? Didn't they see the headlines about the Postal Service trying to end Saturday delivery, in part because first-class mail is disappearing? Letters, cards, bills. These days, we email, we text, we bank online. Increasingly, envelopes in need of return addresses just aren't being sent. Yet the labels keep coming. Make a donation, and you know what you'll soon receive. Or sometimes a group surprises you with labels, in the hope you'll send back a check. Thanks to both strategies, I have return address labels with holiday ornaments from the American Diabetes Association, birds and flowers from the Nature Conservancy, a cartoonish frog from the March of Dimes. Amnesty International's labels have its yellow candle logo, of course, and the U.S. Olympic Committee just cannot stop sending my husband red, white, blue, and gold ones on behalf of Team USA. After my father died at age 93, I threw out thousands of labels he'd accumulated in just a few years of living at a seniors community. Let me stress, thousands. Charities say address labels work. They help get people's attention. But surely they work less well than before. These days, surely they cause as much irritation as appreciation. So come on, charities, get with the times. If you're determined to send me something, make it really useful, or maybe really retro. How about, I don't know, a pen?
Susan Levine is a writer based in Washington, D.C.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which we found in the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, a study that says just drawing pictures of comfort food can make you feel better. Forget about eating them. You draw a pizza, your mood improves by 28%. Sketching cupcakes and strawberries boosted spirits among the study participants by 27 and 22%. The losers, sadly, were the control group who got low-fat and obviously low-comfort fresh peppers to draw moods there, improved only 1%. We hope we improve your mood more than that. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 8 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ added 16 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.